how many of your clients would like to save money on taxes? Is that a fairly ubiquitous interest? I don't know of any client that doesn't want to save money on taxes. So today we're going to cover the entire spectrum of tax mitigation strategies. And I break it into three phases. Well, I do break it into three phases, but I may not be able to use the clicker to do so. So I break it into three phases of tax mitigation are the accumulation phase, when you're making money, the distribution phase, when you're receiving money, and the transfer phase, or the legacy phase, when you're transferring your money to the next generation. Does that make sense to everybody, those three phases? How many of you in the room fall into one of those three phases? Okay, if your hand doesn't go up, I'm concerned, because all of us, and in fact every client, is going to be at one of those. I'm getting hearing a lot of feedback, so I'm trying to drop this down lower. Every client is going to be in one of those three phases and will have interest perhaps in many of those phases, multiple phases. And there are some of the strategies that transcend or branch the different phases as well. So we'll talk about all of those. Does that make sense to everybody, kind of the big picture of what we're going to cover? So when we talk about accumulation phase strategies, the first accumulation phase strategy that we use for tax mitigation is one with which all of you are familiar. It's simply an IRA, right? You get to take money, set it aside for retirement, and get an immediate tax deduction for that. Thank you. I'll pull it up in there. It's in the... So an IRA, and again, whether we're talking about a traditional or a simple or a SEP, IRAs represent the first of our tax mitigation accumulation phase strategies. All right, there we go. So accumulation, distribution, and wealth transfer or legacy phases. So the first strategy under accumulation phase, IRAs, traditionals, simples, SEPs. What's the most that a client can set aside and get a tax deduction for setting aside that money in an IRA, traditional IRA today? $5,500 plus, and I heard the $65 as well, plus if you're over 50, you've got the $1,000 catch-up. What's the most that you can set aside in a simple, I'll use simple first, what's the most you could set aside in a simple IRA? $12,500, and then $15,500, you've got $3,000 catch-up if you're over age 50. So $12,500 and $15,500. In a simple and in a SEP, what's the most that you can set aside? Okay, I'm hearing 53. It's actually up to 25% of your income, up to 53 in a SEP IRA. Okay, so that's $53,000 potentially that you're able to set aside for future distributions and get an immediate tax deduction. Does that make sense to everybody why I call that, why that's the first accumulation phase strategy? It's an accumulation deduction right now for a business owner or anyone, a client who's working. The next category of accumulation phase strategy are qualified plans. Qualified plans, as everyone knows, are broken into two different categories. In fact, Jerry talked a little about these yesterday, Jerry Borrowman. So you have defined contribution plans. What's the most that you can put into a profit-sharing plan? That's a great example of a defined contribution plan. What's the maximum you can set aside and get a deduction for? $53,000. $53,000 is the maximum that you can set aside in a profit-sharing plan. So it's the same as a SEP IRA, essentially, in its limitation. So that's the maximum under a defined contribution, again, that you can get for as a deduction. The next category are what we call defined benefit plans. Jerry asked this yesterday. I don't know how many of you were in his group. So what's the maximum that you can set aside in a defined benefit plan and get an immediate tax deduction for? Okay, I hear some very tentative answers, and that's good, because the answer was, it's a trick question. The limit in a defined benefit plan on how much you can set aside each year is not based on what you make or what your income is. in and of itself. It's a back-end calculation. In other words, what the IRS limits is how much you can take out as a benefit in retirement. Does that make sense? That's why it's called a defined benefit plan. The IRS limits the benefit that you can take out of the plan in retirement. Right now, we've got $210,000 is the maximum that you can take out as a benefit in retirement. Now, if I'm, so let's pretend, again, just big picture math for a minute. If I've got $210,000 and my actuarial life expectancy at retirement is 23.8 years, who can do the math on that real fast? 210,000 times 23.8. I chose it on purpose. Comes out as around $5 million, okay? Around, not a round, but a round number of $5 million. So our bucket that we would be able to build while we're working to draw from in retirement is limited to roughly $5 million. Does that make sense to everybody? $210,000 a year as your maximum benefit for your actuarial life expectancy, roughly 23 years. So you've got a $5 million bucket that you can fill. Now, let's pretend I'm Jaron Monk, who's, what, 25 years old? All right, I was close. So I'm 25 years old, and that means if I'm retiring at age 65, I've got 40 years to fill that bucket. You're with me? How much can I put in each year to fill that $5 million bucket over a period of 40 years, if I equalize it during that period of time? Well, but first of all, and I'm going to talk about the constraints in just a moment, but to the limit of contribution would be about $125,000 per year, because if I put in $125,000 for 40 years, I'd have that $5 million bucket. Does that make sense to everybody how that works? Let's pretend instead that I'm Greg. I'm going to advance you in age, and we're going to pretend that Greg's 60 years old, and he's going to retire in 5 years. And he's got to fill a $5 million bucket. How much can he set aside each year? $1 million and get a tax deduction for that. Do you see how powerful that can be? For Jaron, $125,000, well, that's better than the $53,000 he'd been limited to otherwise, but it's not really meaningful, powerful that way. But for Greg, all of a sudden, that's $1 million a year that he can take off of his income and set it aside in a retirement plan, get an immediate tax deduction for that. So a defined benefit plan is far more meaningful the closer someone is to retirement. Does that make sense to everybody? Now, there are a couple of other constraints on the maximum contribution, because in point of fact, no one can put $1 million into a defined benefit plan right now. That's because there are two other limitations. The first is IRS says that if Greg has only ever made $100,000 a year in his lifetime, then he doesn't get a $210,000 benefit in retirement. So it's limited. So let's pretend that he makes the maximum countable wage, which is $265,000. And they go over your three highest years in your industry is how they determine that. So they take the average of your three highest years in the industry. If it's 265, that would qualify him for the maximum benefit of $210,000 in retirement. But even if he's done that, he still can't put that $1 million in. Anybody know why? Who in here is familiar with DB plans? Why couldn't he put that in? If he's earned enough to qualify for the 210 in retirement, he still could not put in $1 million a year for those 5 years. Well, but you made 265, which was enough. Oh, fair enough. You're right. You didn't even have the money to put in it. Okay, I'm with you. But conceptually, yeah. No. That's you're absolutely right. If you've only made 265, but let's pretend you were making $1 million and they were only counting 265, which is the most that they will count against the 210,000. So now you've got the $1 million to put in it. You still can't under DB plan. Here's why. Because the IRS requires that we calculate interest earnings on both the contribution phase and the distribution phase. Does that make sense to everybody? So if he earns 5% on his money, now all of a sudden he might only be able to put in $300,000 or $400,000, because we have to account for interest earnings on the contribution phase and the distribution phase. Does that make sense to everybody? I know we're right after lunch, but I'm seeing kind of some blank stares out there. So does anybody have a question on that, how that works? So if that's the case, yes, ma'am. Oh, thank you. That's just where I was headed. So if that's the case, on a traditional defined benefit plan, the IRS imposes an assumed calculation for the interest rate. So it's about 4%, 4 to 5% right now. However, let me ask the question, and Liz is going to tell me whether I've explained this well enough. Do I want to make a high rate of return or a low rate of return to maximize my contribution level? The lower my rate of return, the more money I can put into it because it's calculating a lower interest credit. Therefore, I can get a higher deduction. So the very richest of the defined benefit plans is actually what's called a 412E3. They used to be called 412Is. For some of you that have been in the industry a long time, they used to be called 412I. They changed the section of the code that covers them, so it's now a 412E3 plan. In a 412E3 plan, they require that the instrument that is used for the investment, the money that's going into the plan, must go into either fixed annuities or whole life insurance, period. That's it. In fact, even with the whole life insurance, you can only go up to 50% of the contribution into whole life insurance. Because what happens to the cash accumulation inside a whole life insurance policy in the first few years? It's good or bad? What's your rate of return? It's negative inside that life insurance policy. So because of that, and because we get to use the guarantees inside the fixed annuity and the life insurance policy, a 412E3 allows us to put in the very maximum contribution, get the largest deduction possible right now. Does that make sense to everybody? Any questions on that? The answer is yes, but we can layer a defined contribution on top of a defined benefit plan, but we do have to account for the income that the defined contribution plan would generate in retirement as well. So that takes me perfectly, thank you, to the next question or the next answer, and that is, so how much is the maximum that you can actually put in a defined benefit plan? The maximum depends on each individual, depends on their age, their income, how long they've got until retirement. The most I have ever been able to get into a DB plan was about $430,000 per year. But that's pretty significant. For a business owner that might be making $100,000, if he can put $430,000 into a defined benefit plan, and let's pretend he's got another $100,000, $150,000 of deductions that he can write off, we just took him from being in the top marginal tax bracket to maybe being in the 33% marginal tax bracket. Does that make sense to everybody, what that can do for a business owner? Yes, sir.
But he's still subject to the age limit in terms of contributing or participating, right? After age 70, he can't put in money.
That's a fascinating question. In point of fact, he can actually continue to contribute after age 70, but he also has to be taking out his required minimum distributions.
Right, the RMD is going to be a lot smaller than what he can contribute, isn't that right?
Correct. So we can, in fact, I did this with one gentleman in particular where he was at age 70, and in fact he was 72, so we put in place a defined benefit plan because he had earnings, was making some great money, and we were able to actually put a little more in the plan because we were taking it out the back end as a required minimum distribution. So that's a great question. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay, but for those that were with me yesterday, what's the first drawback to a qualified plan solution? Okay, excellent. It must be non-discriminatory. So you're exactly right. Todd gave me the answer I was looking for because he was in there yesterday, and it's the difference between paying tax on the seed or paying tax on the harvest. A qualified plan gives you a deduction on the front end, but when the income comes out on the back end, it is all taxable, okay? But the other challenge, thank you, it's Greg? Greg, thank you. The other challenge with a defined benefit plan is that it must be, it's ERISA governed, it must be non-discriminatory. So if Kyle's trying to do this as the owner of his company for himself, and he puts in $400,000 for himself, he has to put in a commensurate benefit for all of his employees. Now, there are some ways that we can manipulate that, or the code allows. There's a particular design called a cash balance plan that allows us to still put in a significant contribution and minimize how much you have to pay for the other employees. But if you have employees, there's a cost for them in setting up the plan, because you will be required to put in a contribution on their behalf. That's why many business owners with more than 3 or 4 employees typically steer away from a defined benefit plan. Thank you very much, Greg.
Is that true for a defined benefit plan?
It is. It's also true for a defined contribution plan. The difference is that in a defined contribution plan, we can utilize the safe harbor provisions, and typically what a business owner is going to do is contribute roughly 3% of the wages for his employees. So it's candidly, in a defined contribution, it's a little more palatable often than a defined benefit plan to be able to include all of your employees. The cost of including the employees is less in a defined contribution. Okay? Thank you. Excellent questions. Isn't this stuff fun? This is so cool. Okay? Should we go on from qualified plans? So the next solution for a business owner for immediate tax deduction is what I call a defined benefit alternative plan. And that defined benefit alternative plan utilizes Section 79 of the tax code. 79 of the tax code allows an employer to provide up to $50,000 of group term life insurance for his employees or her employees without having to impute to them the economic benefit of that $50,000 of coverage. That's how Section 79 is usually used. The code, however, specifically authorizes or allows permanent benefits to be used instead of group term insurance. So, bottom line is this: a business owner can use a Section 79 permanent benefit plan to set aside much more money for himself. He still has to offer it to his employees, but here's the effect. Let's pretend, I'm just going to grab a name out here. Let's pretend it's Darcy. Okay, and let's pretend Darcy is my receptionist. Bless your heart. Darcy's my receptionist, and he makes $25,000 a year. And so I'm going to put aside $300,000 or $400,000 in a Section 79 plan. So I have to offer, again, it is an ERISA-governed plan, so I have to offer a similar benefit to Darcy. So I say, okay, Darcy, I'm doing this for myself, so I'll put aside, maybe it's $100,000 on your behalf into the Section 79 plan. You just have to pay the taxes due on that, because that'll be imputed to you as a wage. So you're going to have, and typically what's imputed back to the participants, the owner as well, is about 60%. So you're going to have $60,000 of taxable income, but the money went into a life insurance policy, into premium and a policy. So you don't have any money to pay your taxes with. You're just going to owe another, you know, whatever, $25,000 in taxes this year. Would you like me to do that for you, Darcy? Okay, that's exactly the challenge. So because they would receive a benefit which would be taxable to them but would not receive any income to cover that taxable benefit, a Section 79 plan typically becomes what I call a discriminating, non-discriminatory plan. Everyone with me? It must be non-discriminatory, but by its very nature, it is discriminating.
And does it matter whether it's permanent or term?
It has to be permanent to have the significant benefit of being able to set aside a lot of cash, because what you're doing is building cash value inside that Section 79 plan.
Question on those. I've done some research on those, and at least as I understand it, please correct me if I'm wrong, there's two companies that offer a plan that supposed to be qualifies them. Now, the one has enough audits against it that they discontinued doing it. The other one has seen that and they've discontinued it.
Perfect. They both discontinued. Two companies offered product for a Section 79 plan: Pack Life and LSW, the only two companies out there that offer a Section 79 product. Both of them suspended sales last year on Section 79 because of some audits. Both of them have now purportedly reopened the product, because, again, the issue was that discriminating, non-discriminatory plan, IRS came back and said, wait a minute, you haven't even really given your employees, many employers were not even letting their employees know what was available to them. And so the IRS said, that's abusive. You haven't really given your employees that option. So there are some additional disclosure requirements that are now in effect for all of those companies in order to try to make a Section 79 more palatable to the IRS. Bottom line is this. A Section 79 derives its benefit by using I can use the term, knowing that it's not politically correct, but functionally it is. They use a suppressed cash value policy, because the more cash value that builds in that early on, the lower the deduction that the business owner, or it's not the deduction, it's the amount of imputed income that he receives on the back end of it. So it's really it's a low-performing life insurance, permanent life insurance policy. Both of them use IUL, LSW and PAC Life use an IUL product. But it's a low-performing product. The bottom line is there are some other strategies that will generally generate more tax-free income for a client in retirement, even taking into effect the lack or the loss of the tax benefit on the front end. So I don't often recommend a Section 79, but my objective here today was to give you the spectrum. So I talk about it so that you understand what it is and know what's out there. If you have a situation that you think might merit it, feel free to give me a call and we can explore it. Yes, sir.
Implying then that the money you put into the 79 plan, basically into an insurance policy, is tax deductible?
Yes, it is. Tax deductible under the code, under Section 79 of the code. Roughly, again, the employer has to be a C corporation. The employer gets to deduct 100% of the premium. Then the employee, and that's why it has to be a C corporation, because if the business owner is also the employee, an employee of the company, he is imputed the economic benefit of that contribution, but unlike a 162, which we'll touch on in just a minute, where he's imputed 100% of that benefit, he's only imputed about 60% of the benefit. So if 100,000 went in for that and he put 100,000 of premium in the plan, he would only have to pay tax on about $60,000. So that's the advantage in the C Corp. So that's the advantage. Thank you. I'm sorry if I didn't clarify that. Is there any other questions? Does that make sense to everybody? So you get a tax deduction, a partial tax deduction on the front end, and tax-free distribution on the back end. Okay. Yes, Greg.
So the corporation gets a $100,000 tax deduction. The individual who may be the owner of the company has to pay tax on $60,000.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Okay. Any other questions? Yes, ma'am.
The ownership is this deal, is it like personal or is it
become? Thank you. It's personally owned life insurance. It's not corporate owned life insurance. It's very important.
Tax deductible on the 40%?
No, it's not tax. In fact, the person ends up with a $60,000 income bill that he has to pay tax on. Now, if he's the owner of the company, he can distribute income to himself to cover the taxes on that. But he doesn't get the deduction. It's the company that gets the deduction for providing that benefit for its employee. Does that answer your question? Not enough? All right. Let's visit a little more afterwards. I'd be happy. Again, please know, this is my world. I love this stuff. So call me anytime. Talk to me anytime. I'm happy to explore the specifics of how any of these work. But for the moment, I wanted to at least provide an overview for everybody. So with that, I'll move on to the next. The next type or classification of immediate tax benefit for an employer is utilizing 831B, often referred to as captive insurance, or actually more correctly, probably captive reinsurance positions. So in an 831B, an employer is taking and setting aside money in an account that is used to insure against risks. Now, 831B, let me just ask, how many in here are familiar with 419A? Have any of you, were any of you in the industry back when 419As were abused? Okay, is everybody, okay, Greg, what's your feeling about 419A? Wouldn't touch it. Thank you. That's exactly what I was looking for. It is my opinion that 831B has become the new 419A. They are very over-abused designs. There are some very legitimate applications of 831B. But unless you use a legitimate application, I really think the IRS, much like 419A plans, IRS is going to come back and disallow the deduction that was taken. So under an 831B, it's very simple. 831B was created with the Tax Reform Act of 1986. It was designed to provide an incentive for business owners to provide or create their own insurance company to insure against risks that they weren't able to get insurance on the market for. Biggest group of advocates for this were farmers back then who were trying to get crop insurance, and crop insurance was just really, really expensive. So IRS said, fine, you can do and insure against your risk yourself, have your own insurance company with some limitations. There are three tests that must be met for an 831B to be legitimate. First of all, there must be a risk transfer of risk from the employer to another entity. Unless that risk transfer occurs, it's not truly insurance. That's anybody in here will understand that that's required for insurance, is that there must be a transfer of risk. The second requirement is that there must be a distribution of that risk, often referred to as pooling. There are a couple of safe harbor provisions from 2002 and 2009 that tell us that as long as we have at least seven different entities participating in this pooled risk, then it's kind of like a safe harbor provision, and we know that the IRS is comfortable with that. So it must be pooled amongst at least seven additional entities, non-related entities, or non-related risk entities. The last piece is that it must be what they call fortuitous risk. Easiest way to explain fortuitous risk is to explain the opposite. The opposite of fortuitous risk is risk that is when, not if. Who can give me an example of a risk that you all have that will happen to every one of you, you just don't know when? Death. So you have life insurance. That's a non-fortuitous risk. Fortuitous is the opposite. It must be an if, not when it can occur. Does that make sense? If it's a definite event and it's just the timing, that's not a fortuitous risk. Generally speaking as well, the IRS does not favor utilizing a captive solution for insurance coverage that you could just buy out on the market. Now, there are captives out there, in fact, some very effective captives for workers' compensation, where you could actually go out and buy workers' compensation or insure it in your own captive. That's really the only exception that's out there that the IRS is okay with. If I were trying to insure my own car insurance risk, IRS would say, no, that's really not fortuitous risk, and it doesn't qualify under 831B. So 831B is utilized by business owners to set aside money that would otherwise be taxed as ordinary income. They put it in the policy, transfer the risk, have it pooled on the back end, but whatever comes out after that isn't used up for claims, comes out to the business owner as a dividend. Dividends are taxed as, who knows? Long-term capital gains. Dividends are taxed as long-term capital gains, again, as long as it's in there at least 12 months. So it's taxed as long-term capital gains. What the business owner just did was take money that might have been taxed at 40% or 50%, and it is now taxed at 15% or 20% as a long-term capital gain. Does that make sense to everybody? That's the arbitrage that's taking place with a captive insurance. There's also, in fact, I helped design a medical allied reimbursement company that uses 831B that's really exciting for employers that have at least 25 employees and that are providing some type of a medical insurance benefit for their employees. It can be a really, really cost-efficient solution for them. So that's captive insurance. The next grouping here are things like buy-sell agreements, executive bonus 162, restricted property trusts, which again utilizes 419A. It's the only part of 419A that is still, the IRS is still comfortable with, but it has some very rigid constraints. A restricted property trust must be funded for exactly 5 years. No more, no less, or if it goes more, you have to do another 5 years. It's 5-year increments that it must be funded. If it's not funded all 5 years, then the substantial risk of forfeiture clause comes in. That's how you avoid the constructive receipt. Substantial risk of forfeiture comes in, and your premiums are gone. So it's really restricted property trust. There's a lot of, I hear about them often. I'm asked questions on them often. And they're really a very niche product. Their application is really fairly narrow. But they can be a good solution in the right situation. I skipped over 162 executive bonus. I should touch on that. 162 executive bonus allows an employer to provide a discriminatory bonus to his employees. That's 162 allows that. The bonus must be what's considered, quote, reasonable compensation. It's the grayest area in the code. Lots of court cases, tax court cases over 162s. Deductions as high as $1 million have been upheld for a 162 executive bonus. So the employer gets to deduct 100% of it, but the employee realizes that income. It shows up either as a distribution. In fact, under 162, it would show up as wages on his W-2. So that becomes often unpalatable to the employee. It's the same problem that Darcy had earlier. I gave him $100,000, but he now owes $40,000 in taxes on it, and he's making $25,000 a year in income. Not a chance in the world that he can do that. So it became very unpalatable for employees unless they were very highly compensated employees and had sufficient excess income to cover the taxes due. The alternative was then the employer could double bonus. So instead of bonusing $100,000, I would bonus $150,000 to Darcy so that he could pay $50,000 in taxes. In fact, probably $161,000, but that's a whole other calculation I won't go into. But so I'd have to bonus $161,000 so he'd pay his taxes and net the $100,000 that went in as premium in his life insurance policy. Does that make sense to everybody? That's how 162 works. Yes, sir. No, in fact, 831B cannot be funded with life insurance. The funds for 831B, while they are at risk in that insurance coverage, whatever risk is being covered, they must, in fact, be liquid. They must be in cash or cash equivalent investments. Once that particular policy has expired and it becomes what's called earned premium, then it can be taken out on the back end as a dividend. It can also be invested on the back end. So, thank you. Any questions on 162? There's one product out there that was designed to solve that problem. It's actually a Voya product. What they will allow a person to do is the company gets to put in the $100,000, but they'll allow Darcy, it's a self-owned policy, it's not a corporate-owned, thank you for asking that earlier so I can remember that. It's a self-owned, so it's owned by Darcy. He can take a withdrawal from his policy next year of $40,000 to pay his taxes. So now the company put in the $100,000 that it wanted to. He still has a retirement benefit. He just pulls the $40,000 for his taxes out of the policy itself. Does that make sense? Kind of slick. It was really, I think, a very creative solution that Voya came up with for an executive bonus solution. So when I said that 79, there are other options, I can typically get more retirement income out of a 162 executive bonus for the same dollars using that particular product and that strategy than what I could get on a Section 79. So I don't do a lot of 79s. Again, there might be some specific situations where 79 is the ideal solution. I probably should have said that to begin with. For those that know me, my title is Director of Advanced Solutions. That's what this is to me. These are like every case that I brought into is like a great big jigsaw puzzle. And I'm trying to fit it together and find the ideal solution for the client in that particular situation. So when I say 79 has seldom been the ideal solution for a client. 162 executive bonus, particularly using that solar product, can be a very effective solution. Any questions on 162? Restricted property trust, the other thing I didn't mention is that the employer contributing the money into a restricted property trust gets about a 70% deduction. In fact, the employer gets 100% deduction, and only about 30% is imputed back to the employer as an economic benefit for which he is then taxable. So he gets about a 70% deduction on the front end individually as a business owner on a restricted property trust. The backside, however, is that he only gets to take out tax-free on the back end. Everyone's familiar with utilizing life insurance that way, right? You take it out tax-free on the back end. He only gets to take out tax-free the portion that is allocatable to that 30% that he paid tax on the front end. So on the back end, instead of that income being completely income tax-free, it's only partially income tax-free. Does that make sense to everybody?
So the RPP, if the employer, right? No, the employer. So he owns this policy when he set up this plan.
Yes.
So he can still access the cash value.
Correct, in a restricted property trust. Yes. That's an interesting question. Again, in a restricted property trust, it must be funded for exactly 5 years at the same amount for exactly 5 years. After that, there is potential access to the cash value in the policy. But during the first 5 years, it is not accessible. The cash value is untouchable, literally untouchable.
So the first 5 years is untouchable, but after 5 years, the policy owner, just the person, right?
Correct.
You can touch the cash value.
Yes.
But based on our whole life insurance, the cash value they can use as a loan, they won't have a tax consequences.
Correct. You're exactly right. And that's why RPTs are used, so that we can generate tax-free income on the back end. The problem is that they only paid tax on the front end on 30% of it. So when it comes out as income on the back end, it is not entirely tax-free. Even a loan. It's kind of like a MEC. You guys want me to go there, but like a modified endowment contract, the death benefit is still tax-free, but your cash value is taxable. And so it's kind of a hybrid. It's a great question. It's like a hybrid design where on the back end, once you take income out and the insurance company, there's only one carrier I know out there that offers a restricted property trust life insurance product, and that's Penn Mutual. So it's candidly a nightmare on their part to try to maintain the records to determine on each distribution that comes out what portion is tax-free and what portion is taxable. But that's what they have to do, much like the exclusion ratio on an annuity where you've got basis in there and on a non-qualified annuity and you're receiving an income stream from a non-qualified annuity. You have basis, which is subject to the exclusion ratio, which means that a portion of that payment is taxable and a portion of it is not taxable. It's return of basis. Same principle applies in the restricted property trust.
So that means after 5 years, still the policy owner can't really access the 100% cash value because it has to follow the MAC, the rule, right?
That's right.
If they touch the 70%, then the 10% penalty will apply first, and then the pay tax on the...
Interesting, yes. And it's so a restricted property trust. Here's the takeaway really for an RPT is that is a very narrow niche product. That's what I hope you, as you walk away today and you hear RPT, you think, man, there's a very, very narrow niche that is really a good solution for. But for that narrow niche, it can work very well. Yes, Greg.
Quick question going back to the Section 79 plan. There's two companies that offer that. Why are there certain reasons why other policies can be used?
The answer is yes, because again, in a Section 79, it has to be designed so that cash value is very slow growing, because the faster the cash value grows, the more of that more of the benefit that is imputed and taxable to the executive. So if you had a really strong cash accumulation policy, you might not even get a 10 or 15% deduction. You'd have 80 or 90% of that imputed back to you as the economic value, and now the cost of setting up the plan doesn't even make sense to use it. So that's why we have to use a very low, slow cash accumulating design. So, okay, we're not even out of the accumulation. I've got like 6 minutes left. So let me... Oh, thank you. That's right, because we started a little late. That helps. That helps a little bit. So we'll at least try to get to the other phases. All right. Thanks. So the only good thing is that I don't see too many of you falling asleep out there. So I'm grateful for that, particularly right after lunch. But thank you for your questions and your interaction. It's important. My goal here is to help you guys have enough of an understanding to be able to recognize situations where some of these solutions might be applicable. So after restricted property trusts, I would then talk about deferred compensation. You've got 457B, you've got 457F, you've got 409A, all of which sections of the code that apply to deferred compensation solutions. After that, you have key man coverage or key person coverage. You also have ESOPs. ESOPs have some very significant tax advantages. The challenge with an ESOP is the employer loses some, in fact, must lose control in order to have the tax advantages that derive from an ESOP. So many business owners aren't anxious or excited about losing that control. There are some ways that we can mitigate that in the structure of an ESOP, but an employee stock ownership program provides some significant tax advantages to the company. Lastly, I threw up their net unrealized depreciation. How many of you are familiar with NUA? Okay. I see a hand. Is it Jay? Jay, can you tell us how NUA works, or do you want me to?
Somebody's got stock in a company inside their 401k. They have the ability to get back to the basis of what they actually paid for that stock, pull it out front, pay the taxes on it, and then move it over into something else related online. They can use it. Pay the capital gains up when they sell the stock later down the line, which is paying income tax on.
Thank you, Jay. That's perfect. That's exactly it. So if an individual employee has a high concentration of their own company's stock in their 401k plan, then a net unrealized depreciation allows them to take out the basis. It's the only time that you really count basis inside a qualified plan. But if it's employer stock inside their 401k plan, we can pull out the basis, essentially, and tax that as ordinary income. All of the growth is taxed as a capital gain. It's really the only time inside a qualified plan that you can get capital gain treatment instead of ordinary income tax treatment. Agreed. And it's a great way for an advisor to establish some rapport with a CPA to say, you know what, can I come talk to you about net unrealized depreciation? And it's a great way to establish a relationship with a CPA. Thank you. Any questions on NUA? All right, then let's move to ideal candidates. Ideal candidates for any of these accumulation phase strategies are simply business owners that are paying $50,000 to $500,000 or more in income tax. If they're paying $50,000 to $500,000 or more in income tax, we can probably reduce their tax burden. And so that's when we would try to utilize one of those accumulation strategies. So moving now to the distribution strategies. The simplest and easiest tax-advantaged distribution strategy is simply a Roth IRA. Because you paid tax on the front end, particularly those that were there yesterday, you paid tax on the seed, so now the harvest is entirely income tax-free. Everyone with me on that? Okay. So that's the first of the distribution phase strategies. Some people will ask, should I use an accumulation phase strategy or a distribution phase strategy? The answer is it depends. Every situation is different. Often we will try to utilize some of both. Get some immediate tax deductions and build some instruments that will provide some better taxation or tax mitigation when you're taking the income out. But that's a Roth IRA. Next one would be simply tax-free municipal bonds. There was a gentleman again yesterday that talked about tax-free munis. For those that are familiar with tax-free munis, they can be a very effective tax mitigation instrument. There are some significant challenges with muni bonds today, or getting into muni bonds today. Biggest, or probably two of them is what I would say. First is that I've got some great muni bonds I could sell you in Stockton, California, and Northern Las Vegas, Detroit, Michigan. I see a few cryptic smiles out there. Why wouldn't you want those tax-free muni bonds? Because they're functionally worthless. Okay, municipalities nationwide statistically are insolvent or bordering insolvency, and they didn't define that, so I'm reluctant to give the statistic, but they said they're insolvent or bordering insolvency at a rate of nearly 40%. That's really harsh. And here's fascinatingly, just because we already talked about this, I'm going to give you the insight. So what is causing most of those municipalities to border insolvency is, in fact, the defined benefit plans for the government workers. That's what is causing most of these municipalities to really have financial difficulty, because they're trying to meet these defined benefit pension plans for their government workers, their employees, and it's just killing them.
These defined benefit plans are so sticky running the same thing. Neither one of them are designed for longevity.
Agreed. Greg? Okay, fair, agreed, because they used very unrealistic projections for the interest rates that they thought they were going to be making on that money to be able to define the benefit that they were going to provide as a pension for their employees. So, but that's the big picture. That's the... You know, that's a whole nother issue, because I will come to that if we've got time at the end.
Recipients of
TARP funds. Yeah. So the second concern with tax-free muni bonds today is, where are interest rates today compared to historically? We're at an all-time low. In fact, that's what qualitative easing is all about, is this artificial suppression of interest rates. I gave a guarantee yesterday that taxes would go up. Didn't say for whom, but I guarantee they'll go up. I also guarantee interest rates will come back up. Again, how high they come up, when they come up, I don't know. But I guarantee they'll come back up. And if you've got into a tax-free muni bond today that's maybe offering a 3% dividend, and down the road when you want to get out of it, the market's offering 5%, who wants to buy your muni bond that's paying 3%? If you've got anybody that wants to do that, let me know, because no one's going to want to do it. So you'll have to sell it at a discount. If you put it at 100, you might have to sell it for 70 to make up for that interest rate disparity. So tax-free muni bonds can be a good strategy. Today is probably the worst time in the history of ever to be getting into tax-free muni bonds. The next distribution phase strategy is, in fact, what I talked about yesterday, a Roth conversion alternative or a Roth alternative. Euphemistic, really, for overfunded life insurance. That's really what a Roth conversion alternative or a Roth alternative represents. Section 79 comes across because since the taxes were paid on the front end, it comes out entirely tax-free on the back end, on a Section 79. Captive insurance, we already talked about that. On the front end, you saved ordinary income taxes. On the back end, you're paying capital gains rates. So that's why it's under there as a distribution strategy. In fact, I've actually designed an additional phase or element to a captive solution, where if we funnel it through a life insurance policy on the back end, taking out a loan, servicing the loan at the applicable federal rate, we can actually funnel it through a life insurance to defray those savings about 5 years and pull it out completely tax-free on the back end. That's kind of fun. In fact, I had a group of car dealers that did extended service agreements, their warranty program, through a captive solution. And they brought me in because the advisor that was working with them, they'd come to him and they said, we don't like paying this 15% in taxes on the millions of dollars that we now have in earned premium inside our captives. My first thought was, holy cow, you just saved 40 on the front end and you're complaining. You wanted 15's much better than 40. But they still wanted something better. So that's when I came up with that solution on the back end, that we could actually defer it a few years and pull it out income tax free. The next distribution strategy is actually what's called premium financing. I'm sure many of you are familiar with premium financing. What we're simply doing is using a collateral asset to secure a loan that's used to pay the premiums into the policy. You guys who know me and those as you get to know me will find I am very conservative by nature. I have never done a premium finance solution where I have not required that the owner of the policy actually contribute to the interest cost. Some people will sell them as a no outlay from the owner of the policy. All you do is secure the collateral. What that does is put a really heavy drag on that insurance policy. And there just is, I don't believe, any insurance policy out there that can overcome not only the drag of the loan, but also the drag of the loan interest. So in a premium finance case, what someone is doing is really paying interest on the loan instead of paying the premiums into the policy. They're using some collateral to secure that loan for the lender until the cash accumulation inside the policy reaches a point where that loan can be released and the policy then becomes self-sustaining. So that's a premium finance design. Most often, premium finance is used as a legacy or a wealth transfer vehicle. It can be used as a distribution vehicle if the participants are starting young enough. Maybe at Jaron's age, you could generate a decent income, tax-free income out of that life insurance policy. At my age, it's probably almost too late to try to use it for a distribution strategy. Yes, sir.
Premium financing basically implies that you're going to get a loan from someplace else to buy the policy, right?
That's exactly right. You're borrowing money from a lender to pay the premiums into the policy. You're using collateral to secure that loan. Typically, what's most often used today is actually real estate, even though that's not the favored by the lenders, that's not the favored solution. But we can use real estate. Most often it's actually a letter of credit. Even if someone has real estate, lender will require a letter of credit to secure the loan. So now let's pretend it's $1 million a year in premium that we're putting in for 5 years. So the owner of the policy is going to pay interest on that loan instead of putting $1 million and paying $1 million in premium. So the owner of the policy pays interest on the loan. The $1 million goes into a life insurance policy. That life insurance policy builds cash value. So maybe by 10 years, that life insurance policy has, I don't know, $8 to $10 million of cash value. We put in $5 million on the front end, $1 million for 5 years. By year 10, it might have $10 million of cash value. We now take and pay off the loan for $5 million. The client's been paying the interest.
Pay off the loan to the bank.
To the bank. That's right. We pull it out of the policy, pay off the loan to the bank.
And now you've got a policy loan, right?
Correct. But now that policy loan will still sustain itself for the rest of their lives. And even after they pay off the policy loan, they will still have a net death benefit of maybe $10 to $15 million. So that's how a premium finance solution works. Okay? All right. Ideal candidates for distribution phase strategies are anyone with more than 250,000 qualified assets. Again, we talked briefly yesterday about that for an RCA type solution, and anyone with at least $25,000 of annual disposable income. One of the things I didn't have a chance to get to yesterday, and I'm looking at the time, and we didn't even get to the wealth transfer, so I'll fly through those. But one of the things I didn't get to yesterday is that if someone is contributing to their IRA or a 401k right now, and they're not getting a match on that contribution, often it is smarter for them to be contributing into a non-qualified asset so that they have more control and don't have to deal with the taxes on the back end, RMDs and things that we talked about yesterday. So I didn't have a chance to touch on that yesterday. But so if they've got more than $25,000 of disposable annual income, they're candidates for some type of a distribution strategy. Wealth transfer, obviously Roth would come across, tax-free muni bonds, RCA, DB alternative, each of those have a death benefit component to them, or at least with the Roth IRA and the tax-free muni bonds, they would transfer tax-free to the next generation. Premium finance has a death benefit element to it. So now I get to some new strategies for wealth transfer and legacy. That would be using a single premium immediate annuity to fund a life insurance policy. That can be a very effective wealth transfer solution. Others are charitable gifting. We can get into CRUTs and CRATs and CLATs. Some great solutions. An advisor brought me a client that owned a strip mall for about $8 million. She was generating the income and living off the income from the strip mall. We were able to move the strip mall ownership into a CRUT, still supplement her income. In fact, we could give her more income than she was getting from the strip mall currently. And we used a portion of that to buy a life insurance policy for $8 million, so her children got the $8 million all over again. It was a great solution for her using a charitable remainder unit trust. And there are lots of categories. Those that are familiar with charitable remainder unit trust, you've got CRUTs, and you've got NIMCRUTs, and you've got NICRUTs, and lots of variations on those. CRATs are charitable remainder annuity trust, and CLATs are charitable lead annuity trust. So another charitable gifting, very popular charitable gifting strategy is family limited partnerships, family foundations, support organizations. Each of those have their fit, and there are times when their one might be better than the other. Another wealth transfer strategy is ILETS and SIUL. Everyone know what SIUL, second to die. You could do SWL. Their Mass Mutual has a very good second to die whole life product. So you can do, it's just a second to die life insurance product inside an irrevocable life insurance trust that pulls it outside of the estate. Ideal candidates for wealth transfer are anyone with $10 million or more of projected net worth. And that's the last thing I want to emphasize. We're really close to being out of time, I think. But last thing I want to emphasize is that when we talk about estate taxes, and let me first say that estate planning is much more than just dealing with estate taxes, right? There's estate equalization issues. There's estate liquidity issues, even if you don't have to deal with estate taxes. But someone today, a married couple today, age 60, married couple, 60 years old, they have an estate of $4.5 million. Do they have an estate tax problem? Ah, that's what I expected. I would challenge that or question that. I would question that because if they're 60 years old and they have an estate today worth $4.5 million, and you as an astute financial advisor are able to exceed the rate of inflation by 3% a year. So let's pretend you can get them 6% and inflation is 3%. So you've exceeded the rate of inflation by 3% a year on your growth of their estate. In 30 years, they will have more than the estate tax exemption, even with its inflation adjustment for that 30-year period of time. Does that make sense? So hopefully that gives that's an aha moment for everyone in here that someone who has an estate of $4 to $5 million today, or an individual who has an estate of over $2-2.5 million today, is still susceptible to an estate tax problem, even under today's estate tax rules. I submit that it's not going to stay the way it is right now. But that's a political discussion we won't get into today. But I anticipate that the $5 million or $5.45 this year that each individual gets, I think that's going to drop way down. Used to be $1 million. I wouldn't be surprised to see it go back to $1 million. And now someone that's got an estate of $5 million today definitely has an estate tax problem. But even without a change in the tax law, someone who has an estate of $4 to $5 million today could very reasonably have an estate tax problem down the road. And then obviously anyone desiring to leave a legacy. So at least we got all the way through them. Thank you very much for your participation and your time.